Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
The first degree.
You see it on the news, you see it on the paper, you see it on Facebook.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
That was the first time I think cognitively I've ever realized that there's really bad things that happen to people that are good. And people that are undeserving of that. It's not something that's always on TV. This is real life. This is their family. And just the reality of the world is really, really broken.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter. How are we feeling on this fine Wednesday?
Oh, we're feeling good. Hump day. Yeah.
I'm glad that we ended up releasing our podcast on Wednesdays. It's like something to really get you through the week when you're dragging.
Well, and once you've hit Wednesday, the week's basically over.
It's basically Friday.
Yeah, it's basically Sunday. You're having brunch right now. Perfect.
Sunday's too scary. It's basically Saturday.
Saturday night. Perfect.
I love it. Before we start today's episode, just a reminder for Patreon, if you want some more true crime, first degree content, join us over there on the Firstie Underground. We've got some new first season there, and it feels good.
Feels great. We're growing steadily, rapidly. We've got good content. We're taking your submissions. We're covering the cases you want. It is a freeing, inclusive, amazing situation over there.
Absolutely. So join us over there. But I think that is enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
Every day, families across the world are thrust into the tragedy of dealing with the murder of a loved one. In the aftermath, grief often mixes with anger, creating a complex emotional landscape. It's natural to harbor resentment towards the perpetrator, to hold on to anger in a world shattered by loss. Yet amidst the anguish, there are those who choose a different path. They find solace not in anger, but in forgiveness. Through their journey, they offer a beacon of hope to others grappling with similar tragedies. In a society steeped in notions of rehabilitation, their courage to forgive stands as a testament to the resilience of the human spirit. Today's episode is an example of this resilience, showcasing the transformative power of empathy and understanding in the face of unimaginable loss.
Today's case begins on November 29th, 2005. This was 5 days after Thanksgiving, so many people were just getting back into their work routine after a long weekend filled with food and family. The top movie in theaters was Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, one of my favorite movies of all time, and this is the fourth movie in the Harry Potter series. It went on to become the most successful film of the year, ranking in almost $1 billion. Other recently released movies included Rent, Just Friends, and Walk the Line. The top songs on the radio included Run It by Chris Brown, Gold Digger by Kanye West and Jamie Foxx, and My Humps by the Black Eyed Peas. This was an interesting time for music.
Appropriate hump day song, by the way.
Very hump day song.
So the setting for today's case is Morgantown, West Virginia. Located in the north central part of the state, Morgantown is home to West Virginia University. Their mascot is the Mountaineer, and their unofficial song is Take Me Home, Country Roads by John Denver. In 2005, when today's story takes place, the population of Morgantown was just over 25,000 people. Today, it's not much bigger, at 30,000. Although when WVU is in session, there are many more people flooding the streets. Our first degree for today's case is named Nicole, and she grew up in West Virginia, surrounded by her parents and their best friends, Steve and Stacy.
They weren't even like best friends. They were like my aunt and uncle, like essentially. So they were more so than a lot of my family. Like they were at every birthday party. Like we literally, like their kids are like, I feel like family too. Like we're just all so close.
Nicole's family was also close with Steve's father, Denny, who just so happened to be their pastor at church.
We went to a small Baptist church here locally, and he was my pastor all growing up. And this man is just the most incredible man you could ever meet in your life. He loves people so deeply and so strongly. And I know that that's something that I see through Steve. They just have a desire to help people like pretty much no one I've ever met. I know that Denny and Steve, they just spend their whole life serving and helping people. And I know that's something that he ingrained in his sons, and to just love and help people. And he is truly, truly one of the biggest lights in our community.
While growing up around Steve, Stacy, and Denny, Nicole got to know their family members, which included Steve's brother, Jimmy Michael, and his second wife, Shelley.
I remember Jimmy he got along so well with Steve, his brother, because I knew Steve really well, that when him and my dad and them were all together, like they were all just pals. They were just seemed like kind of grown up kids to an extent, too.
James Andrew Michael, who went by Jimmy, was born on February 20th, 1972, in Cumberland, Maryland, to parents Denny and Ruth. And as we already know, Jimmy had a brother named Steve, and they were really close brothers. Steve and his parents loved Jimmy's quirky sense of humor, and he really knew how to make people laugh. He was also gregarious and a huge teddy bear.
Right, and during his teenage years, Jimmy attended Fort Hill High School, where he played football and got good grades. After high school, Jimmy studied respiratory therapy at Allegheny College. In 1992, he graduated with an associate's in respiratory therapy. He then applied to West Virginia University, known as WVU, and was accepted as a chemistry major. At that same time, he took a job at Ruby Memorial Hospital. And on his first day there, he met a respiratory student named Stephanie. Stephanie had the vibes. He was into it. And they started dating. And by early 1993, they were engaged to be married. By the following year, they were married and had a baby boy together.
For the next few years, Jimmy continued working at Ruby Memorial while finishing his bachelor's in chemistry at WVU. In 1997, he and Stephanie welcomed a daughter together. And after this, their relationship kind of became on and off again. There didn't really appear to be one main reason why their relationship didn't work. They just weren't the best match. We see this all the time. Although some have suggested that Jimmy was never really in love with Stephanie to begin with. And that could be why he so easily became enamored with his fellow Ruby Memorial Hospital co-worker, Shelley.
Michelle Lynette Gutz, quite a name, who went by Shelley, was born on January 21st, 1972, to parents Michael and Kathy. And while growing up in Clarksburg, West Virginia, Shelley was a straight-A student and a star cheerleader. At only 5'1" and 90 pounds, she was really great at being held up in the air with pom-poms. After graduating from high school in 1990, Shelley was accepted into WVU, where she first studied pharmacy. She dreamed of being on the cheerleading squad for the college, but it didn't happen for her during her freshman year.
Then in early 1992, 20-year-old Shelley started dating a fellow student, and soon she was pregnant. That December, she gave birth to a son. But it wasn't long before she and her boyfriend broke up. He refused to marry her, and that was a big deal breaker. Now a single mother, Shelley managed to attend school part-time, but she wasn't really feeling fulfilled there. She still wanted to be a WVU cheerleader. So she decided to try out, and she ended up making the squad. Her mom started helping her take care of her son while she had practice and her classes.
Next, Shelley decided to change majors, and she applied for the School of Nursing, which she was accepted into. She then focused her sights on becoming a pediatric nurse. And after that, Shelley's life continued changing in big ways. During the summer of 94, she started dating a guy named Rob Angus. They married the following summer, and Rob legally adopted Shelley's son. In October of 96, they welcomed a baby girl together. The following spring, Shelley graduated with a bachelor's in nursing. She then became a registered nurse in the pediatric intensive care unit at Ruby Memorial Hospital in Morgantown. And it's all coming full circle. It's there that she meets Jimmy Michael and his first wife, Stephanie. So they all work together there.
And Stephanie was not the biggest fan of Shelley. According to Stephanie, Shelley was really always over the top. She would do things like perform cheerleading moves in the pediatric intensive care unit. That is so inappropriate. She would also just walk over to her coworkers, do a high kick, giggle, and keep walking. So, like I said, extremely inappropriate. Like, imagine you're a parent, you have your kids there, and you see somebody doing, like, it's number one, cringe, and number two, just so wildly inappropriate.
It's giving big pick-me energy.
Huge pick-me energy, but like in the worst like atmosphere setting that you could ever do that in. At a bar, okay, still cringe, but like this is bad.
Not around sick children where the stakes are really high. Like it's not about you. It's about the sick children.
Yeah, it's like, give me attention. It's just, I mean, pretty much the biggest red flag I think you could ever have.
It's not great. And our first grade Nicole also remembers Shelley being just a bit over the top as well.
She's really a lot. Definitely loud. She wasn't shy. She's not someone that I think you would ever describe as like a passive, shy, quiet. She was definitely made her space known.
Shelley was also known for flirting with the men that she worked with, including married Jimmy Michael. According to Shelley, she and Jimmy would talk off and on at work. He confided in her that he and Stephanie were having relationship issues. And at that time, Shelley and Rob were having their own issues as well, so they ended up connecting over this, which honestly seems like a recipe for disaster.
Right, and by the fall of 1998, Stephanie suspected something was going on between Jimmy and Shelley. And soon, she left him. And Shelley's husband left her too. Now two marriages were broken, and all four people were going through rough divorces and child custody hearings.
And once the divorces were finalized, Shelley and Jimmy got married and moved into a big, beautiful home. It was in the 500 block of Killarney Drive in Morgantown, only 5 minutes away from the hospital. The home was big and brick, with four white columns out in the front. The neighborhood was well kept, and their backyard had enough room for a trampoline, a slide, a swing set, which was great for the couple's now blended family.
Jimmy eventually left the hospital to start a medical supply business named Mountaineer Home Medical. And his company specialized in respiratory and sleep therapy. He was very well-liked, and his patients really loved him. He was the kind of guy who took the time to answer questions. He truly cared. Jimmy also coached peewee football in his spare time, while Shelley coached the cheerleaders. It kind of seemed like a fairy tale match, which Jimmy's parents, Dennis and Ruth, later said was really important to Shelley. She apparently was all about appearances, and she wanted everyone to think that they were the perfect model family. But, of course, things aren't always what they seem.
It was during this period of Jimmy's life that our first degree Nicole came to know him and Shelley. At this time, Nicole was pretty young. She was in second or third grade. And because of how close her family was to Jimmy's brother, she would see Jimmy and Shelley at family events like birthday parties. And one time, Shelley babysat Nicole and her sister.
I can't remember what everyone was needing to do in Morgantown, but we were all going up there and Shelley was going to babysit us while they all went out and did something. So I remember being up there. I remember like hanging out with Shelley and Jimmy's kids. We were playing at their house. I remember just it being really fun. I remember her being, Shelley in particular, being really loud and just like cool and seemed kind of like go with the flow, like a really chill, fun mom.
As the years passed, Nicole continued seeing Jimmy. Then on November 29th, 2005, when she was in sixth grade, she heard the news that something terrible had happened. There had been a fatal fire at Jimmy and Shelley's house, and Jimmy had been found dead inside, the victim of a murder.
I remember my parents just talking about like how to help Steve through this and how to be a support for him, and then realizing like, oh my gosh, it was Steve's brother. That was the first time I think cognitively I've ever realized that there's really bad things that happen to people that are good and people that are undeserving of that. It's not something that's always on TV, or I remember being like terrified as a child of true crime, and now it's something I love, but I remember I would beg my parents to turn off if they were watching like Criminal Minds or whatever, and then being like, oh my gosh, this isn't on TV. This is real life. This is Steve and Stacy. This is their family. And just the reality of the world is really, really broken.
So what in the world happened to Jimmy? Who killed him and why? Why would anybody want the gregarious, sweet, and caring Jimmy dead? To answer these questions, you know the drill. We gotta go back.
On the night of November 28, 2005, Jimmy and Shelley were home alone. Jimmy's kids were with their mom, while Shelley's were with their dad. And according to Shelley, Jimmy went to sleep early that night. At around 6 a.m. on what was now November 29th, Shelley left for her shift at the hospital, and she says that Jimmy was still asleep when she did leave. She arrived 10 or 15 minutes later and started her normal work routine.
At about 10:30 a.m., Shelley was at work when she got a call that her house was on fire. Neighbors had seen smoke and called 911, so Shelley rushed back to the house. There were firemen everywhere, and she started asking, "Where is Jimmy? Where is he?" The firemen told her that they didn't know yet.
For the next half hour, firefighters worked on putting the fire out. And when it was safe to search the home, they found the badly burned body of Jimmy in the upstairs primary bedroom. He was lying in bed, or what was left of it, after the fire. And firefighters then broke the news to Shelley that Jimmy hadn't made it.
Word of the fire and Jimmy's death spread rather quickly. Everyone who knew Jimmy was completely crushed. You know, he was a popular businessman and a peewee football coach. He really was a pillar of his community and a lifesaver to his clients. He was a beloved father, son, brother, friend, and so much more.
When detectives showed up at the scene, they were under the impression that they were dealing with a routine fatal fire. But when they started examining characteristics of the scene, there were some immediate red flags. One detective later told 48 Hours that the fire damage on Jimmy's body was unlike anything he'd ever seen. Typically, the intense heat of a fire causes muscles to contract, but that didn't happen in this case. Jimmy was found lying completely flat on the bed, as if he'd been deep asleep throughout the entire fire. It didn't look like he'd tried to get out of bed or tried to escape the flames or anything like that.
Arson investigators were brought in to look over the scene, and they noted heavy smoke damage throughout the house, but the only fire damage was in the primary bedroom, where the windows and door were found closed. Investigators determined that the fire was deliberately set on or around the bed and an accelerant had been used. The fire was officially determined to be arson, but it was still unclear how Jimmy died. They'd have to wait for the autopsy results.
3 days later, the results were back, and they confirmed the detective's concerns that something here just wasn't right. It turns out Jimmy had not died in the fire. There was no soot in his breathing passages, which meant that he was dead before the fire was started. Unfortunately, it still wasn't clear just how Jimmy had died. There were no obvious signs of trauma to his body, which, again, had been badly burned. But given all these circumstances, it seemed likely that he'd been murdered. So toxicology reports were ordered. However, they wouldn't be available for weeks or possibly even months.
While waiting for the toxicology results, detectives kept investigating the arson and Jimmy's death. They immediately focused their attention on the person closest to Jimmy, his wife, Shelley Michael. You see, from the moment the detectives arrived on the scene for the fire, Shelley had made an impression on them, but for all the wrong reasons. They quickly noticed that she wasn't acting like a typical wife who had just learned her husband was dead. In fact, she didn't really have a reaction at all. No shock, no crying, nothing. And of course, we know everybody grieves differently and does weird shit when they're grieving, but it just seemed really odd to them that she had no reaction whatsoever.
Right, and when the detectives interviewed Shelley at the scene, she continued acting rather abnormally. She was cool, calm, collected, as she explained that she'd been at work the entire morning and didn't know Jimmy was dead until firefighters told her. And one detective later recalled that even before the autopsy results came back, quote-unquote something kept drawing him back to Shelley. There was just something about her that wasn't sitting right with him.
And come to find out, things didn't sit right with some of the people who knew the Michaels either. Rumors started spreading that Shelley had been responsible for the fire and responsible for Jimmy's death. One anonymous caller even suggested that she used a specific drug called rocuronium to kill Jimmy. Rocuronium is commonly found in hospitals, like the one that Shelley worked at, and is used in an emergency situation when a patient needs to be intubated. The drug paralyzes the body, including the throat muscles, so the breathing tube can be inserted. But the patient is always put on a ventilator to help them breathe, because without a ventilator, an injection of rocuronium causes slow suffocation to death.
When I was growing up, I took French in high school, but I could never get the language to stick. I wanted to be fluent so bad, but it never happened. I just couldn't focus and I couldn't practice enough, and it didn't work. But thankfully, there's Rosetta Stone, which is the most trusted language learning program, and it's available on desktop or it can be used as an app on your phone or tablet. Rosetta Stone is different. It immerses you in so many ways. And with its intuitive process, you can pick up any language naturally, first with words, then phrases, and then sentences. And before you know it, boom, conversations. Plus, with Rosetta Stone's true accent feature, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the First Degree listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/first. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/first today. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for all of your springtime goals. If you don't have time, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. So you just get to eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. You really just heat and savor the good stuff without all of the stress. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Plus, you can pause and reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution to premium, fast meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I'm so busy, so it's amazing to just have Factor meals in the fridge for whenever I realize that I'm starving and I don't have any time to cook anything. They're amazing, they're healthy, and they keep you fueled all day long. Head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. With their suspicions set on Shelley, detectives began looking into the Michael marriage. So to those on the outside, Jimmy and Shelley seemed like the perfect couple, like Shelley wanted to be perceived. Shelley was always put together. She always wore really cute outfits. She always had her hair and makeup done perfectly. And when she stood next to Jimmy in photos at events, she posed with her big smile beaming. But when detectives interviewed their friends and family, they learned like that with every marriage, they too had struggles, no matter how perfect they wanted to seem. And they also had struggled with infidelity.
And as the saying goes, once a cheater, always a cheater. And as it turns out, Shelley had been having an affair with a guy named Bobby. And he wasn't just some random guy either. He was a delivery driver for Jimmy's company.
That's just such a messy move.
Oh, yeah.
The affair that was in fact happening didn't end after Jimmy had tragically died. When detectives spoke to Jimmy's dad, Denny, they learned that he had actually walked in on Bobby and Shelley the night before Jimmy's funeral, and that they were canoodling, they were hugging and kissing. And after Shelley noticed Denny in the room, she immediately shoved Bobby away, pretending like she was like fighting off this advance. Mm. But Denny had seen enough and also seen the truth, and then also seen her acting like, you know, that would be a really troubling thing to discover.
Horrible.
It's one thing to walk in on someone kissing, but then to pretend that it was unwanted, it just shows like a whole glimpse into this person's sort of MO and psyche.
And a day before his funeral, like this girl.
How distraught could you have been, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, all this looks even worse when you learn that after Jimmy's funeral, she never contacted Jimmy's family again.
So detectives interviewed Bobby and asked if he'd been having an affair with Shelley. He actually admitted to the affair and said it started when he and Shelley went on a business trip to Chicago. When they got back home to Morgantown, the affair continued. In fact, he'd seen Shelley just 3 days before that fire. He'd gone over to her and Jimmy's house, and they had sex in the same bed that Jimmy was found dead in.
Detectives asked Bobby where he'd been at the time of the fatal fire, and he said he was working at Jimmy's company. And detectives looked into Bobby's claims and found that he was telling the truth. Throughout the day, he'd been making deliveries or at the warehouse. It didn't look like Bobby could be responsible for this. That put detectives back at square one with the same person of interest, Shelley Michael. But there was the whole issue of her also kind of having an alibi for the time of the fire. She'd been at work the whole morning.
But detectives were so suspicious of her that they decided to see if her alibi was as strong as she was making it seem. Had she really been at work the entire morning? They pulled surveillance footage from the hospital, which showed that Shelley was a liar. She had left the hospital grounds for a total of 17 minutes on the morning of the fire. She left at 8:11 in the morning and came back at 8:28. So this was the first verifiable crack in Shelley's story, and it told detectives that they were right on track.
Detectives then spoke with Shelley's neighbors and found that at 8:20 a.m. on the morning of the fire and the murder, one neighbor saw Shelley run out of the house and screech out of her driveway with her wheels spinning. This sighting lined up with the camera footage timeline that they'd found. Another neighbor, who was actually a firefighter heading to work that morning, also saw Shelley at around the same time. She was stopped at a four-way stop right by her house. When he waved at her, she didn't wave back. This firefighter also recalled smelling something burning at that time, but he didn't see smoke or flame, so he just kept on driving to work.
So around the same time that detectives pulled the security footage from the hospital, Shelley asked if she could come in for a voluntary interview with the detectives. They, of course, were like, yeah, come on in. And to the detective's surprise, she came in and spoke to them for 9 hours without an attorney present. During this interview, Shelley explained that on the morning of November 29th, she kissed Jimmy, who was still asleep, on the forehead before she left for work at 6 in the morning. She got to the hospital 10 to 15 minutes later, and Shelley said that the only time she left was to retrieve a forgotten pager from her car. She insisted that she never left the hospital grounds.
The detectives then dropped the bombshell on Shelley. They knew for a fact that she did leave the hospital grounds. They had captured her on surveillance footage, leaving for 17 minutes. She boldly told them that they were wrong, that she never left. She was defiant. The detectives then informed her that multiple neighbors had also seen her at her house during that 17-minute period. So with some additional prodding, Shelley finally broke and admitted that she did leave the hospital grounds. But according to her, it was only briefly and to run an errand.
During this interview, the detectives also asked if Shelley was having an affair, and she repeatedly told them no. At this point, they didn't let her know that Bobby had already told them that she indeed was having an affair with him. And before Shelley left, she refused to take a polygraph.
So at this point, needless to say, detectives were convinced that Shelley was in fact involved in Jimmy's death. But they weren't positive if she'd been the arsonist too. Yes, she'd gone home at around 8:20, but the fire wasn't reported until 10:30. With that timeline, the fire had to have been going, blazing, for 2 hours before anyone discovered it. So was it possible for this to happen? Detectives had to answer that question.
So they brought in arson experts from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF. They ran some tests, which included building 6 models of Jimmy and Shelley's bedroom. These models were exact replicas down to the mattress, carpet, and the paint. The windows and doors were closed as well. The models were then set on fire in various ways to see if it was possible for the fire to smolder for around 2 hours before flames were noticeable enough for somebody to call 911. After several failed tries, the experts were able to get the bedroom to erupt in flames after smoldering for a total of 2 hours and 12 minutes. This meant that it was possible for Shelley to have set the fire at around 8:20 in the morning. And this meant that she could be the killer and the arsonist.
And I just want to clarify, I don't really believe in this kind of testing.
Yeah.
Like, we did a whole season on Unraveled about arson experts and trial experts. Arson testing is like notoriously wrong a lot. Mm. However, in this case, the evidence against her is pretty strong otherwise, you know? Yeah. So I think this actually just helps to bolster their claims.
It's not like it was like the smoking gun or anything.
If it was the only thing they had on her, right? Like, yeah, she's been lying. She got caught lying about leaving the hospital. Like,
the affair. Like, there's a lot more going on here, and we've only touched on the evidence so far. But I just want to say, I don't normally support this kind of like testing, because if you do the research, arson testing is like notoriously incorrect.
Yeah.
So with all this information in mind, detectives continued looking into Shelley and Jimmy's marriage. They learned that the couple had a $200,000 fire insurance policy on their house, which if you adjusted for inflation in today's money, would be over $310,000. So after the fire, Shelley filled out a 34-page insurance claim where she wrote out all the items lost in the fire. And this is interesting. She was so extremely detailed. She had items listed on there like 12 bottles of nail polish worth $72, 30 pairs of Jimmy's dress socks worth $240, and even a frame for their wedding vows worth $40.
Detectives also found out that 10 months before the fire, Jimmy and Shelley had taken out $500,000 life insurance policies on themselves. These policies would be worth about $780,000 in today's money, so that's a pretty good chunk of cash. Shelley was the sole beneficiary of Jimmy's insurance policy, and his kids were not listed, nor were hers.
So things are not looking great for Shelley, but they were about to look a lot worse. In February of 2006, more than 2 months after the fatal fire, toxicology results for Jimmy finally came back. And they were damning. They showed that Jimmy died from a lethal dose of rocuronium, just like the anonymous caller had suggested.
And like we talked about before, this drug paralyzes the body, and without a breathing tube, it causes people to suffocate to death. The medical examiner estimated it would have taken Jimmy 13 minutes to die. During that time, he would have felt like he was being buried alive without being able to move. So now it made sense why there were no signs of him trying to leave the bed that he was found burned on.
Right, and when our first degree Nicole learned how Jimmy was killed, she was understandably heartbroken.
It just seems like such a painful way to go, too, to, like, the medicine I know paralyzed him and kind of made him, like, suffocate. And, like, that just seems such a horrific way to go. I can't imagine doing that to someone that you spent part of your lifetime with.
Once they had the toxicology results, detectives theorized that Shelley stole a vial of rocuronium from the hospital. It would have been readily available to her in the pediatric ICU. All she would have had to do was use her key to unlock the drug cabinet and slip it in her pocket. Detectives figured that at some point on the morning of November 29th, Shelley injected Jimmy with a paralyzing drug, likely while he slept. Then at around 6 a.m., she left for work as usual. At 8:11, she left work, drove 5 minutes home, lit the fire, and hightailed it the 5 minutes back to work.
Nicole couldn't believe that Shelley would steal medicine from potentially needy people and then just to use it to murder her husband.
Taking medicine, like, you're working with sick kids every day, like, you are helping these kids stay alive, and then you're doing this. Like, I can't imagine, like, you're working in a helping field and this is the way you're acting. It's unfathomable.
Nicole told us that the hospital later made changes to their policies to keep rocuronium in a more high security area, and I would say that that's for the best. That's an insane drug.
On March 10th, 2006, more than 3 months after Jimmy was found dead, Shelley was charged with first-degree murder and first-degree arson. Shelley's arrest and the confirmation that Jimmy had been murdered was huge news in Morgantown. At that time, murders were a rarity there, but a murder involving a prominent businessman and his very petite, beautiful WVU cheerleader nurse wife was something that was completely unheard of. It was the stuff that happened on TV shows, not the stuff that happens in Morgantown.
Nicole's parents were beyond shocked to learn that their best friend's brother had been murdered by his wife.
I remember in particular hearing my mom say to my dad, she babysat our kids. She killed Jimmy and she has babysat our kids. I don't even remember the initial conversation even before that, but I just remember hearing her tell my dad, oh my gosh, she babysat our kids and she did this horrific thing and I let her watch my children.
While Jimmy's murder was shocking, there was never any doubt that Shelley was responsible, at least in the eyes of Jimmy's family.
I just know from hearing Steve and Stacey talk, and like that's who I was around, like that's the only side of things that I was hearing, was that Shelley was involved and that there was not a doubt in their mind that it was Shelley.
Nicole looked back on her time with Shelley and realized that she could see Shelley being a murderer.
It almost seemed like a fake, or like there wasn't anything surface. If that makes sense. Like, she was just, like, outgoing, like, controlling a room. But, like, I feel like sometimes those people, there's a little bit more to them that they're hiding, or they're actually insecure about something. And so I feel like to a degree I can see it. Obviously, it was still extremely shocking because it's someone you know and someone you care about, their family. And so by extension, you care about them. But I feel like I can see it.
Nicole recalled her parents constantly checking in with Steve and Stacy, who were having to travel to Morgantown for pretrial hearings, along with Steve's parents. Their whole lives revolved around this tragedy, and there was no way for them to escape it.
Pastor Denny at this time, he took some time off, of course, but then he came back as a pastor. And so that's a huge part of his life. So that was getting, you know, worked into sermons as well. And we were watching him go through all of this kind of every week as well.
Meanwhile, Shelley was released on $450,000 bail. She was put on strict home confinement at her parents' house in Clarksburg. She wasn't supposed to leave, but Shelley was never one for following the rules. She left her house literally all the time to do things like get her nails done. Her attorney explained to 48 Hours that Shelley didn't follow the rules because she was indignant that she was being accused of the murder of her husband. This wasn't a valid excuse for the court system, so her bail was revoked and she was sent back to jail until her trial.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't, and the real world makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For The RealReal, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on TheRealReal.com using code FIRST. That's TheRealReal.com using the code FIRST. In July of 2007, Shelley's trial for murder and arson began. Everything was moved 150 miles away due to the pre-trial publicity. Of course, Jimmy's family attended the trial. And while they were all convinced that Shelley was guilty, there was still a twinkling of fear that she might weasel her way out of this. Remember, Shelley's a petite woman. She's an attractive woman. She was a former WVU cheerleader and a nurse who literally worked with and handled babies. It was a possibility and a fear that maybe the jury would refuse to believe that someone like her could kill someone.
I remember just them constantly worrying, was something going to go wrong where this was going to all of a sudden turn? Was something going to be brought up that they weren't prepared for, they didn't know about? I know in particular, too, it was hard. They said seeing her physically in the courtroom and just having that much anger and hurt and then actually having to physically see her. I remember the anticipation of not knowing. They weren't confident either way.
Almost immediately, Shelley showed her true colors. She was completely indignant at her trial, just like she had been while she was out on bail. She often smirked at the cameras and the people in the courtroom, which has to be really disturbing.
We're looking at a picture from, this is from in court.
She was in court. She's giving like a thumbs up and like the biggest grin on her face. Like she's like, hey, it's weird.
It's not good. It's a bad look.
Bad look, dude.
So the prosecution told the jury that Shelley was responsible for Jimmy's murder and the fire that was set to cover up said murder. The prosecution theorize that Shelley injected Jimmy with the rocuronium before heading off to work at 6 a.m. Then just after 10 a.m., she left work and went home. And she knew at this point that Jimmy would no longer be alive. And this is when she would have set the fire to cover things up. And after lighting the fire, she just returned back to work.
In short, Shelley had only been gone for 17 minutes, which may seem like a really short period of time, but the prosecution said it was important to remember that she only lived 4 to 5 minutes away, which meant only 10 minutes of that time was spent driving. That left 7 minutes, plenty of time to start a fire. And after Jimmy was found dead, Shelley pretended like she wasn't the killer. She lied to police at every turn, eventually telling them more than 100 verifiable lies.
The prosecution told the jury that Shelley was their only suspect during that investigation, and she was the only person that had a motive to kill Jimmy. She stood to gain $700,000 from Jimmy's death with the $200,000 fire insurance policy and the $500,000 life insurance policy, which she was the sole beneficiary of. That's a lot of money. But what makes this motive even more sinister is that Shelley wasn't under any financial stress at all. She wasn't desperate for the money as a family. They weren't hurting for money. She was just greedy for money.
I can't remember if my mom or Stacy, but one of them talking about, like, she was making decent money. She was a nurse that was making decent money. And, like, I remember them being like, I don't understand why. Like, she's going to get insurance money more than she would have being a nurse, but she was making a decent amount of money.
The prosecution said that there was at least one other motive for Jimmy's murder: the affair that Shelley was having with his employee, Bobby. Bobby actually testified for the prosecution and detailed the affair that he had with Shelley. Jimmy's dad, Denny, also testified about the affair and about the night before Jimmy's funeral when he walked in on Bobby and Shelley hugging and kissing.
Shelley's defense was that she was completely innocent. She did not murder Jimmy and she did not set the fire to the home. Her attorney told the jury that there was no hard evidence against her and that she had no motive. Not even the affair, which they admitted did happen. However, the defense said that having an affair didn't mean she was the killer. They told the jury that she had a reputation for loving, cheating on, and leaving her partners, not killing them.
The defense said it was unbelievable to think that Shelley could leave work, light the fire, and get back to the hospital in just 17 minutes. And what was even harder to believe was the fact that the fire had gone undiscovered until 2 hours after she allegedly started it. The defense questioned how that was even possible. How could the fire smolder for 2 hours without anybody noticing? They mentioned that yes, arson experts had been able to recreate this happening, but only after multiple failed tries. The defense accused the experts of manipulating the tests until they got the results that they were looking for.
Which, if there wasn't other evidence against her, I would say could be valid, but yeah, that's for another podcast. But the defense further told the jury that authorities never looked at anyone but Shelley as the killer. And that was a problem. They didn't fully investigate other obvious suspects like Jimmy's ex, Stephanie, who he had gone through a very contentious divorce with. And aside from that being a potential motive, Stephanie also had access to the alleged murder weapon, rocuronium, since she worked in the same hospital as Shelley. To make matters even more suspicious, Stephanie was unaccounted for between 7:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. on the day of Jimmy's death. And when questioned, she told detectives that she was home with her baby, but there wasn't anyone who could corroborate that.
As part of the defense's strategy, Shelley took the stand. She told the jury that she had absolutely nothing to do with Jimmy's death or the fire. Her attorney then spent a long time having her explain away all of the lies that she told police. When asked why she lied to detectives about leaving the hospital on the morning of the fire, Shelley testified, "I didn't want my boss to find out. I didn't want to get fired." And when asked why she lied about having an affair, Shelley said, "I was ashamed of myself. I just cheated on my husband and didn't want to cause any more pain or make it worse."
During closing arguments, the prosecution showed the jury just how quickly Shelley could have acted when killing Jimmy. They injected a grapefruit, demonstrating that it would have taken only a few seconds for Shelley to administer a fatal dose of rocuronium to Jimmy. Then they flicked a lighter to show just how quickly she could have lit the fire. Prosecution admitted that, yes, the evidence was circumstantial, but when put together, it was rather overwhelming. And they asked the jury to answer these questions. Who had access to the murder weapon? Who had access to the home? Who had access to Jimmy's body? And who had motive or something to gain from Jimmy's death? And the answer to all these questions, is an obvious, resounding Shelley Michael.
During their closing arguments, the defense told the jury that Shelley was guilty of lying and cheating, but she wasn't guilty of murder or arson. The defense even suggested that nobody was guilty. Maybe Jimmy injected himself to end his own life. They said it was possible that he staged the scene to make it look like a murder so his family would get the life insurance money. The defense said he knows what Rockeronium does. He is a respiratory therapist. He knows it's going to give him a little bit of time to start a fire and it won't look like suicide. This evidence alone is all the reasonable doubt you would ever need in a case like this. That's laughable.
Right. And as you can imagine, the suggestion really upset Jimmy's family, who knew he would never have done something like that. And during the rebuttal and closing, the prosecution said it was completely impossible that Jimmy took his own life. The autopsy proved he'd been dead before the fire began.
After 8 days of testimony, the jury started deliberating. 11 hours later, they reached a unanimous verdict, guilty on both counts. In addition to deciding Shelley's guilt, the jury also had to recommend whether or not Shelley would receive mercy, which basically meant the possibility of parole. Surprisingly, they chose to give her mercy. Shelley was absolutely shocked by her guilty verdicts, and it was clear that she really thought that she was going to get away with it.
Jimmy's family was so thankful the jury found Shelley guilty, even if it was with mercy. But they weren't out of the woods just yet. You see, prior to Shelley's sentencing hearing, the defense filed a motion stating that Shelley requested and required a new trial because the prosecution had withheld evidence. So the defense was claiming that they were not informed until the trial was underway that detectives knew the identity of the anonymous caller who had called in and suggested that Shelley may have been the one to drug Jimmy.
And it turns out the caller was none other than Shelley's ex-husband, Rob. He had heard from his sister, who used to work with Shelley, that Rockeronium was available to all people working at the pediatric ICU where Shelley worked. She thought it was possible that Shelley had used this Rockeronium to kill Jimmy. After hearing this, Rob called a detective and passed along the info, but asked to remain anonymous. The defense argued that this was important information they should have been informed of before trial. The judge disagreed, saying that the prosecution hadn't withheld anything, and it had been in the police files.
With a new trial denied, Shelley was sentenced for the first-degree murder and arson convictions. At her hearing, she decided to address the court, stating, "I in no way absolutely did not kill my husband. I did not destroy my family and our whole lives. I love my husband tremendously, and I know a lot of people are going to roll their eyes about that. Jimmy is the ultimate victim of this. It reminds me that God has a plan, but I can't for the life of me imagine what that plan is." Shelley then turned to Jimmy's parents and said, "If it's easier for you to blame me, then please do it. I pray every night that the truth will come out."
Jimmy's parents also spoke at this hearing. His mom, Ruth, said, "The loss of Jimmy has devastated me." She said that his death is the first thing that she thinks about when she wakes up and the last thing she thinks about when she goes to bed. She asked Shelley, "What was so horrible about your life that you had to do this? My hope and trust is in the Lord to see me through, and I know He will."
Jimmy's father, Denny, said, "Shelley, you may receive a sentence. You may get parole after 15 years. But I do know this. We received a life sentence." Denny continued, stating, "Shelley, I don't hate you. Never did. I hate what you did. I hate what you did to our family and your family. But I love you. I can forgive. It's stored up in me."
Nicole remembers everybody being in awe that Denny could forgive his son's killer.
That was something I remember them talking about, like that Denny was able to get up there and say that. And that was not something that I don't believe Steve and Stacey were willing to get up there and say to her, but them just kind of being in awe that he was willing to do that.
Shelley was sentenced to serve life in prison for murder and 20 years for arson. The sentences would be served consecutively, and she would be eligible for parole after 20 years, since the jury recommended mercy. When sentencing Shelley, the judge said, "I just settled on one word, cold. Our community is just appalled and outraged by these crimes. It's not like anything I've seen in my 22 years as a judge. I don't think I've ever seen anything as bizarre, as hard to understand. Nothing could justify what happened here, absolutely nothing."
Nicole recalled how overwhelmed with emotion her parents were after getting word that Shelley had finally been sentenced.
Whenever she actually got sentenced, I remember my mom actually crying, just being so happy that Steve and Stacey and Denny were getting some justice, that this was something that they had put so much time and travel and thought and, I mean, just their whole life kind of involved around this.
Shelley appealed her convictions but was denied. Her children went to live with her ex-husband, Rob, who would not let them visit their mother in prison. Jimmy's children stayed with his ex-wife, Stephanie, and they stayed in touch with Jimmy's family.
I am really grateful that his kids still do allow Stacy and Steve in their life. I know that one of them recently had a baby and they got to go see the baby and be a part of the baby shower. And so I'm really grateful that they are still getting to see parts of Jimmy through his kids. And I am really grateful for that. And I know that means so much to them. They're so proud of them.
Very recently, in August of 2023, Shelley requested a new trial, citing ineffective assistance from her defense attorney. However, little progress has been made with this request, and it's still working its way through the system. Shelley and her new attorney have until March of 2024 to submit any necessary paperwork to be considered for a new trial. Then the state will have until August of 2024 to respond.
Jimmy's family is naturally concerned that Shelley might get a new trial, and this might drag them through this painful process all over again. You know, this is kind of the sentence that families of murder victims are forced to serve. They have to be exposed to this stuff over and over. And their worst fear was having to relive these worst nightmares yet again.
Jimmy's family has another reason for concern. Shelley will be eligible for parole on June 2nd of 2027, which is really just around the corner. She'll be 55 years old at the time.
It's just so unnerving because, you know, we're so close to Steve and Stacy. We're so close to Denny. And I don't want her getting out and trying to wreak havoc on them. And I think just knowing that she's out there, like, I can't imagine that Steve and Stacy are going to sleep. Even if she's not in contact with them, we're an hour and a half distance from her, granted she doesn't go somewhere else, but just knowing that she's out there, I don't think you're going to be able to get peace. I don't think you're going to be able to get sleep. I'm assuming she would try to reach out to her kids and grandkids now, just that knowing that she's out there and that you don't really have any control over what she's doing or where she's at.
It's understandable that Jimmy's family would worry about Shelley being a free woman again, but they're not the only ones who should be worried. This woman, if she's capable of doing this to her husband, she's capable of doing this to anyone.
Despite the hardships and sorrow Jimmy's family has faced, they have not given in to their despair. Instead, they've persevered in inspirational ways. Denny, in particular, has gone on to help many families through the profound loss of a loved one.
He says all the time that, like, he obviously would never in a million years want this to happen to anyone and would never want what happened to Jimmy to happen to anyone else. But because of this, he now has this incredible platform to minister and reach out and support parents who have lost kids in a way that he never would have, using the situation and say, I went through something terrible, but I'm not the only one who's went through something terrible, and I'm going to use this situation to help other people who have gone through that. I've had some medical issues myself throughout my lifetime. I have a rare disease, and I just know even when he would come meet with me when I was in the hospital or having a surgery, and he would say, you know, I've went through this really terrible thing, and I get to help people now, and you're going through something that's fairly unique, but you're going to be able to help someone that's going through something similar. And that just really, really stuck with me. He remained a light. His light didn't ever flicker. He just remained wanting to help people and say, this is a tragedy. This is something that I never, ever would want to happen. I wouldn't wish this on anyone, but I'm going to take this and I'm going to use this and I'm going to see if I can help as many people as I can. And it's truly incredible.
Today's case serves as a poignant reminder that amidst tragedy, resilience and forgiveness can prevail. Despite the pain and heartache, there can be a glimmer of hope. It's a testament to the strength of the human spirit to rise above adversity and choose compassion over bitterness. In the end, it's not just about seeking justice, but also about finding healing and closure. Because in the face of darkness, forgiveness is a beacon of light, guiding us towards redemption and peace.
A huge thank you to Nicole for being our first degree for today's case. If you are listening out there and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram, join our Facebook. We are talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon if you're looking for more first degree content. And stick around tomorrow. We'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers.
and keep your friends close,
but not that close. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Haley Gray. Sources for this episode are CBS News, The Times West Virginian, The DA Online, The Dominion Post, The Post Gazette, and John Glatt's book, Playing with Fire. And as always, our First Degree guest is always our largest source.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.